Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Even though there are no large fires burning close to Portland this summer, you can still smell the smoke from all the megafires burning from British Columbia to Northern California. This is the new reality we are facing, a confluence of climate chaos exacerbated by logging old-growth forests, which is exacerbating larger and more frequent wildfires. Today we talk again with Southern Oregon scientist Dominic Della Sala with Wild Heritage in Talent, Oregon, about the importance of protecting mature and old-growth forests from clear-cutting, as these trees play a key role in sequestering and storing massive amounts of carbon, thus serving as a vital natural climate solution. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Good morning to you, Barbara, and all your listeners, and thanks again for having me on your very informative show.
And it's nice to be doing this show in real time. I think it's the first time we've done it real time in about 2.5 years.
Yeah, it's great that we're really actually talking one-on-one with you and all your listeners, too.
And we're talking as things are happening as opposed to trying to imagine what they'll be like by the time the show airs. You started an email that I got from you the other day by saying, "We are in a new climate fire era. A tipping point has been reached. This is our new abnormal. Can't put the fire genie back in the bottle with climate chaos making the rules now." So what did you mean by that?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people are watching the news these days and wondering what the heck is going on. I mean, we just had a Category 4 hurricane hit Florida and wipe out significant stretches of southern Florida. We've had massive flooding in Kentucky and Yellowstone and other regions of the country this year already. And we've had, you know, the continuation of large fires. And so I think that what's happening is Mother Nature is sending us a signal, and we're not listening enough. And the signal is we can't continue to dump CO2 into the atmosphere without seeing these kinds of catastrophic events taking place. And so unless we significantly and quickly curtail carbon emissions, not only from the burning of fossil fuels, but from the logging of natural and old-growth forests, things are only going to get worse. And so I think that's the message that is coming about from these different types of big disturbance events that we're seeing around the country right now. We truly have entered a new climate fire era, and at least the western part of the United States and elsewhere as well.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the water part of the climate chaos before we get back to the fires. One of the things that really struck me watching what's been going on in South Florida is the devastation in Lee County. I take it kind of personally. My parents lived in Sanibel for about 15 years, and they're long gone now, and so they don't have to at least have dealt with what's happened to, and they lived on the Gulf Coast of Sanibel. So where I'm sure that the house they lived in is just gone. But one of the things that struck me, and it used to strike me when I go visit them, is this is a barrier island. This island is supposed to protect the mainland from hurricanes. So there seems to be two components to what we're doing with climate chaos. The first one is pumping all this carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases like methane into the atmosphere, which is causing heating and cooling and all kinds of weird stuff. But the other part of it is what we do with our land use, whether it's clear-cutting older forests in the west or whether it's building up barrier islands all along the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic Coast on the East Coast. So I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about how we have to rethink our land use in order to adjust and be resilient to the mess that we've made in terms of the climate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you're getting at are what we call natural climate solutions. And whether you're in Florida or other parts of the country, there are so many different places that you can be protecting natural climate solutions. For example, in Florida, you want to make sure that you've got a good coastal buffering system of wetlands. But unfortunately, there's been so much development in Florida, wetland destruction, buildings built in the wrong place. Our infrastructure doesn't take into consideration green infrastructure that can begin to ameliorate some of these severe climate consequences by providing that buffer when these storm events get severe, like they're increasingly becoming. And so I think that needs to happen in places that are experiencing severe storms and coastal sea level rise. And in our region, our forests are our best ways of tapping on the climate chaos brakes and slowing things down and giving us time to adapt what's happening in the atmosphere.
Well, I know you also had family in Florida, as I recall, and I wonder what your thoughts are about how to keep people from building back. I think about Fort Myers Beach, which is one of the barrier islands. It's right off of the coast where Fort Myers, the biggest city in Lee County, is. And that place seems like it's just gone. And if I were in charge, I would say, let's not rebuild back. Of course, you've got to deal with all these people who've lost their homes and their livelihoods and their memories and all that stuff. But I wonder how we start to really take a harder stand about not building in these danger zones and finding ways to work with the planet to protect ourselves from the mess that we've made of the planet.
Yeah, you know, it's just Build Back Better has got to embrace natural climate solutions and relocating people to safe places. This discussion, I believe, is happening right now in southern Florida with whether or not they should be buying out some of these residential areas that are going to get hit repeatedly by these big storm events. Some of the insurance companies are pulling out of the region and leaving people with no insurance. And so I think that we need to start asking questions about how we build back our communities, whether we should be building in these unsafe areas. And I just experienced this personally. My town of Talent down in Southern Oregon, half of it burned down in the Alameda fire in the September 2020 fires that swept through Oregon. And the building that's taking place in my town mostly has been without any additions to home hardening, defensible space, the things that we need to be doing in a fire-prone area, we're not doing. We're preoccupied with logging in the backcountry that does nothing to protect homes from these severe disturbances. So we've got to really rethink how we build our communities so that they're safer from these severe events and they're more in touch or more in tune with the natural systems.
Well, I think we've had this conversation about building resilience into the urban wildland interface. And it seems like nobody's been listening to us for sure. But one of the things I'm thinking about is that there was a bill that was being proposed at the Oregon State Legislature level, I think it actually passed, that was going to require some of the things that you're talking about for any kinds of home building or people who already live in the woodland in Oregon. And people fought it back because they didn't like who was being defined as being in a high-risk area. And as far as I know, that bill is on hold now. I don't know how much you know about that, but I wonder how we deal with that kind of resistance on the part of homeowners.
Yeah, I think part of the reason for that resistance is a lot of the funds are misappropriated. So you get kind of lip service to home hardening, when in reality, these bills are loaded with poison pills that include massive amounts of forest logging, as if that's going to be a resilient strategy. And we know it's not. It only makes the situation worse, but it's all about following the money. And so there's a lot of money now that the federal government, for instance, the Forest Service, is practically swimming in money right now from the two bills that passed in this congressional session, the Inflation Reduction Act, and before that, the infrastructure bill, have massive amounts of money for logging in the backcountry that is doing nothing to help homeowners. So those funding streams need to be flipped. And I think if that happens, you'll see a lot more homeowners taking interest and taking notice in incentivizing home hardening and defensible space. And at the same time, we've got to think about ex-urban sprawl. We have millions of homes that have been built into these unsafe locations that took place, you know, post-World War II, when the Forest Service was really good at putting out fires and we didn't have a climate crisis then. Now we've got the climate crisis and we've got millions of homes built in these unsafe places with very little land use restrictions. So we're only making the problem worse as we continue to go into more severe climate consequences.
Well, actually, I think that the problem got a lot worse in the last 20 years, because I spent some time around Colorado Springs back in the early part of this century. And Colorado Springs did not sprawl nearly as much as it did several years later when there were massive fires that took out all these cul-de-sac communities. And I would be looking at maps going, that wasn't there when I was there. And it maybe was like, we're talking about 5 or 7 years difference. So I think there was this mushrooming, actually, of building really close to the wildlands that happened in the last 15 years. Do you think that there's been motivations other than what are obvious for so many people to be building homes and like a lot of McMansions, in fact, in these wildland areas? Though I'm thinking about Paradise, California, where it seemed like a lot of the homes that burnt up there were not high-end homes. So maybe everybody wants to move into the woods.
Yeah, it's that. And, you know, down in my area, again, in Talent, those weren't homes built in the woods, and many of them were affordable housing, and we lost all of those. And it was mostly an issue of not having home hardening as the embers in that fire were blowing sideways and going structure to structure. So no amount of thinning would have stopped that destruction. Home hardening would have prevented a lot of that loss, but that's not the way we're building houses. So we build them, even if we're, you know, not in a forest situation, but we are in a dangerous fire situation, if you don't harden the home, you're going to see more of these catastrophic events. I mean, some of the fires that we're seeing that are taking out towns are grassland fires. And they just go right, they sweep right through the grasslands, jump on a roof, and the next thing you know, it's going structure to structure. And so that's what we have to start thinking about in redesigning communities for home hardening, because these events are not going away. In fact, we're going to see a lot more of them because we keep treating the atmosphere like a CO2 dumping ground.
Well, I used to feel pretty comfortable that I didn't live in a fire zone. And watching Paradise, California go up a number of years ago, I was talking to a friend who I go hiking with a lot, and he said, I wonder if Portland would be the next Paradise. I said, I'm not worried about Portland. I'm more worried about Ashland. And my worry, it wasn't Ashland that burnt up, but the two towns just north of Ashland were the ones that burnt up just maybe a couple years after we'd had that conversation. But also, 2 years ago, I found myself living half a mile from an evacuation level one warning system because of the fires that were burning around the Clackamas River, which were maybe 30 miles from our house, but were threatening lots of Clackamas County. And I live a half mile from the border, and all of Clackamas County was in evacuation zones. So it was kind of a lesson of, even if you live in a city now, you can be threatened by wildfire. So I wanted to talk a little about what that means. Like, I know you live in a much more rural place than we are right here in Portland, but how do we, people who live in cities, have to start thinking about the fact that any place now basically could be a wildfire zone?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I do want to return to the Ashland situation before I answer the urban situation. But, you know, Ashland was interesting because had the winds been blowing in a different direction, it would have taken out a good portion of Ashland. I mean, it just was the luck of the draw, so to speak, that the winds were blowing in one direction and not the other. Unfortunate for the towns of Talent and Phoenix, but Ashland escaped it this time. And the worrying part of it is that Ashland is spending millions of dollars doing backcountry logging and not addressing their home hardening problems as they should. And we did a project a few years ago using satellite imagery to zoom into the Ashland watershed, and we were stunned by the number of homes that are built right in the forest with branches of trees touching structure with very little defensible space. Some of them had no defensible space. You couldn't get fire trucks in or out. And, you know, some of the roofs were wood shake roofs, and that's just a recipe for disaster. And again, if the wind had been blowing in a different direction, Ashland would have been wiped out, and not the, you know, significant parts of Talent and Phoenix. So we've got to worry about those situations. And in terms of urban areas, no one can run away from climate change. And I get this question all the time: where should I move to escape the real big severe damages? You can't. You know, wherever you go, you're going to experience weirdness from an overheating planet. And in urban areas have the heat island effect, and the temperatures tend to soar even worse in those areas. We've seen heat dome waves in Portland and Seattle, and a lot of people don't have air conditioning. So, I mean, if there's an opportunity to redesign our building structures, we should be thinking about biomimicry, having buildings that incorporate vegetation to keep them cooled and keep them warm, and having less of the heat island effect, urban forests and bioswales, green infrastructure to help absorb some of the impacts. This is the way we should be redesigning our cities and our backcountry areas so that we can handle more of these severe climate events, because they're only going to get worse and more frequent if we don't do something quickly to remedy the situation.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Sala with Wild Heritage in Talent, Oregon, about forest, wildfire, and climate chaos. There seems to be a contradiction here, though, because it's, and I totally agree that we need to really green our cities a lot more than we're doing. And Portland has a mixed bag about that, because on the one hand, we have a lot of incredible wild areas in the city, and on the other hand, we're taking out more tree canopy than we're replanting. So that's something for the city to look at. But I think about, here I live in a place where I never really worried about wildfire until 2 years ago. And the place that really worried me is I live about a block from Oaks Bottom Natural Area. And that has burned a couple times, not badly, and the fire department's gotten there in time. But it's an awareness that we have in the neighborhood that that place could go up. And there's a couple times where I have a neighbor who's like the Mr. Good Samaritan. And the last time there was actually, it was a false alarm about a fire. But anyway, he was out there with his hose ready to put out the fire. So we have this issue, I mean, even in neighborhoods like where I live, where there's a lot of trees, and the trees are kind of close to houses. I don't think anybody's houses are having trees touching their roofs. But how do we kind of balance that in hardening our homes in the city at the same time that we are wanting to encourage more green infrastructure?
Yeah, that is really a difficult choice that we face. And, you know, everyone loves to have canopy trees surrounding their house. There's so many benefits of shading and just the beauty of large trees in the neighborhood. And, you know, at the same time, it's a risk. And it's because of the way we have poorly planned our cities to not be resistant to these kinds of events. So I think you've got to work with what you have and make sure that you prune the lower branches of these trees so that fire can't race into the crowns, or is less likely to race into the crowns. Make sure that you don't have any vegetation touching the house. I mean, it really what happens with the science of home risk reduction is what takes place in that 100 feet or 60 feet, depending on slope and aspect, around the house. And if you do defensible space as best you can around the house and you harden the structure, that means screening the vents, it means having properly installed windows that can sustain heat and wind speeds, it means screening your gutters, it means having preferably a metal roof. If you do all of that, then you're lowering your risk. But if your neighbor hasn't done that, then you have the potential for a domino effect where it just goes from structure to structure, which is what happened in Talent. It just went structure to structure, blowing through trailer park homes, taking out all the residential areas because they were not hardened and they weren't planned for this. And it was really a sad event to see this happen to my town. It could happen to any city that is not properly prepared, especially as we see more heat domes and more drought-like conditions that are really what's behind these big fire events now.
Well, I remember a number of years ago, there was a big fire in the Oakland Hills in California, and I have some good friends who live right close to those hills who were evacuated for about a week. And one of my friends who lives three or four houses down from the end of her block and the top, and then you just get up on the drive that goes through the hills. And there were a lot of houses burnt down just like within a few hundred feet of her house. And well, the big culprit was eucalyptus trees, actually. And she told me that her roommate was out there during the fire cutting down everybody's cedar fences and the eucalyptus trees with his chainsaw. And just kind of, and I think he saved a lot of the houses from burning down. So I think a lot of it also is thinking about what you plant and what you don't plant. And I guess people should learn more about eucalyptus and why that is such a fire hazard.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Not only eucalyptus, but wooden fences. There have been studies that show that the loss of houses in a lot of these big fire events is exacerbated by wooden fences. I mean, think about it. If the fire is moving along the ground, it needs to burn something, and then it encounters a wooden fence, which is a linear type of fuel. It just keeps going, and, you know, all fences come intersect something else, and you just kind of have that domino effect that I talked about. So there's a, you know, when we're rethinking how to build these communities, we should not be using wood, because that's what is going to go up in the fire. So we need to look for alternatives in our construction materials, because the wood is just, it's destroying the forest, and it's contributing to the loss of towns because of the flammability properties.
Well, before we get into it, I think is going to be the core of our rest of our conversation today, which has to do with not clear-cutting forests as much as we're doing, or maybe not at all anymore. But there's this last thing, and we've had this conversation before about the aesthetics. When you said we have to, you know, get away from having wooden fences, and I'm thinking about the cedar fence that goes around three sides of our yard. And, of course, our house is 120 years old, and it's all wood, and it's old-growth wood at that. It's hard to imagine living in a place where you'd have metal fences and metal roofs in adjusting to our aesthetics. I know that you seem to have done a much better job of doing that kind of adjustment in your mind than I have, but I want to talk about what are the ways that we can do this that are actually aesthetic.
Yeah, you know, I've talked to a lot of folks that are doing this right now, and there is all kinds of really great, smart business models that are emerging that are finding aesthetically pleasing substitutes. And the trick is the combination of aesthetics and the environmental footprint, and balancing that out and making sure that you're not causing more harm by, you know, extracting minerals from the earth or whatever. But I think there are some real clever options that are coming out that, you know, look at the decking material now that is a composite. And instead of, you know, cutting down redwood forest, you can get a decking material that is a lot less damaging to the environment. So we're seeing more of these alternative substances coming out, and we need to, because, you know, there's just so many people that forests can sustain around the planet, and we're over 8 billion now and headed towards 10, maybe 11 billion by the end of the century. And so that plus our consumption patterns is only making the situation worse for all of us and for future generations. So we've got to get smarter about that and think about our environmental footprint in addition to the aesthetics. Is there some happy medium where we can combine the two and not having as big an impact on the forest?
Well, let's get now into the crux of what I think you want to talk about, which has to do with the amount of logging that's happened of old-growth forests. And there was an interesting bit in this study that you just released, I guess last week, about the shrinking amount of old-growth forests due to lots of clear-cutting, but the interesting fact that they are beginning or could be replaced by what you're calling older forests, which are forests that have grown back from cuts. So first of all, I wanted to talk about what these older forests are and then how that protecting them would compensate for how much we've lost of the original old-growth forests.
Yeah, okay. So I started this project with this bucket list in my head. I've had this wish list of wanting to have a map of mature and old-growth forests and an associated assessment for the nation's dwindling older forests. And I just, you know, kind of scratched my head, why don't we have this? We're one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world, and we don't even know where our mature and old-growth forests are. And unfortunately, I've been working on these kinds of projects with a team of scientists out of Australia that includes some of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change scientists, and we've been mapping these forests around the globe. And I was blessed with North America and being able to do the assessment here. We just released the results from the study that we did in the contiguous United States. We did the Tongass earlier in the year. So we've got a pretty good snapshot now of where our older forests are and the values that they possess. I mean, the sad part of it is, prior to European colonization, much of the United States, where there were forests, were heavily forested with significant amounts of old growth. But over the centuries, and particularly from World War II on, we eliminate all but maybe 5% of our old growth forest in the lower 48 states. Now, Alaska is in a lot of better shape, but down in the lower 48, the contiguous United States, most of the old growth was taken out and accelerated decline during post-World War II. So now we have to figure out what we have left. So because NASA released all of this really cool satellite imagery using laser pulse technology, we were able to map forests in three dimensions. This was done by other scientists, processed the data. We got a hold of it for the very first time and applied it to locating our mature and old growth forests. And what we found from this was only about a third or so of the lower 48 states still have some aspect of mature and older forests. And the good news is that there are places like the northeastern United States and parts of the South that have forests that are maturing, about 80 to 100 years old, that are developing the old growth characteristics, recovering from prior logging. And we've got concentrated areas of old growth, like in the Pacific Northwest, where we live, and in other regions of the country. So we've identified those forests. Only about 24% of them are protected on federal land. That means 76% of the federal older forests are potentially vulnerable to logging. And in a climate emergency and a global biodiversity crisis, we do not want to be logging those forests, because we're just putting more carbon into the atmosphere that is contributing to the fires that we're seeing today and to the global biodiversity crisis. So we are asking President Biden to start a national rulemaking, like what was done for the roadless area protections, aimed at protecting federal mature and old growth forests, because so little of them are protected in our nation, and we need them as natural climate solutions.
So what does that entail?
That entails a public process. Like, there are two executive orders that the president already did around climate change and more recently forest. In 2021, he issued the executive order to begin cataloging the nation's protected areas for possible increases in protections, so-called 30 by 30, to protect 30% of all the nation's lands and waters by 2030. That process started in 2021. But it really hasn't resulted in any policy change. And then on Earth Day, the president issued another executive order around climate and forest to begin an inventory process of mature and old growth for future protections. Well, we've done the inventory, at least a inventory, the federal government's doing their own, and we're presenting that to the government and saying, here's your forests that need protection. Now let's bring these two executive orders together, 30 by 30, and mature forest inventory, and let's get a national public process underway that leads to a policy to protect those forests from logging. Otherwise, we're just contributing to both the planetary biodiversity and climate crises.
A few weeks ago, I read an op-ed in the New York Times by your colleague, Carol King, who was talking about calling on President Biden to do exactly what you're suggesting. And I was curious about how she's connected to the work that you're doing, and if her voice has any more clout with the powers to be than the scientists that you work with.
Oh, yes. Carol's one of my heroes. And, you know, not only do I have her songs in my head, but she is such a wonderful activist for forest in her region and for the country. And I had the distinct pleasure of working with her when the two of us testified in the U.S. House of Representatives Natural Resources Committee. She did such a wonderful job. I helped with the science end of her testimony, and she helped with the publicity end of what needs to happen. And it was a wonderful teaming arrangement. And Carol has the ability, the star power to open up doors that, you know, us pointed-headed scientists just do not have. And it's just that combination of poetry and science and music and science and art and science. Those all have to come together if we're going to solve the planetary crisis. I mean, science can play an informative role in identifying the problem and some solutions, but we've got to communicate to people in ways that anyone can understand, and Carol does that beautifully.
We're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Sala with Wild Heritage in Talent, Oregon, about forest, wildfire, and climate chaos. At the end of Carol's op-ed for the New York Times, she made a reference to her very famous song, maybe her biggest hit, It's Too Late. And I'm wondering if she's going to rewrite that song and make it be, it's not too late if we take some action.
Well, yeah, I think that's why she even mentioned that. And she also was interviewed twice on CNN, and she brought that up and said that she was hoping that that message will get out to the public that, you know, it's getting too late, but it's not totally yet. We're getting close. And I think that's the same thing that climate scientists are saying. You know, the folks that I travel in circles with are really worried that we're running out of time. And, you know, some models show we've got 10 to maybe 30 years before it's irreversible. And there are other studies out there that have been showing that we've crossed a number of major planetary boundaries, like the interaction between the biosphere and the atmosphere is so out of balance now that the consequences are going to increasingly become severe. And because I have grandkids and kids, and I'm concerned about them and the future generation, I'm going to do everything I can, just like Carol and everybody else that's working on this, to make sure that we still have enough time. And we do. But, the hourglass, the sands in the hourglass are running pretty thin, and we've got to transition out of fossil fuels yesterday. And we need natural climate solutions to give us some time, to buy us some time to a more sustainable energy economy.
I've been having some conversations with people, I guess I've been having them for years, but a lot in the last week or so, about why is it that these Republicans and other people associated with the oil and the fossil fuel industry, how can they continue on the way they are? Don't they also have children and grandchildren? I wonder how to make that connection with them, and how, if you have children and grandchildren or care about other people's children and grandchildren, that you can continue to be so reckless in squandering what's left of the Earth's resources.
Yes, and I'll come back to my example with Carole King. And so when we were doing our office visits, when we were back in D.C., Carol had the star power to get actual meetings with members and senators and so forth. And I was in one of those Republican offices, and the representative at the time had his, you know, photo album of his grandkids out and was talking about his grandkids. And turned out that he wanted to thin the forest and log the places that I wanted to protect. So the next day, when I was in front of the congressional committee, he really challenged me in what I thought was a very inappropriate way. I could have taken the bait and really went to town with him, but he basically called me a communist for my views on nature and for an elitist attitude that we all should be driving $60,000 EV instead of gas-powered cars. And I could have gone into my defense mode, but instead, I channeled my inner peace, and I just said to him, I said, Congressman, I really enjoyed my visit with you yesterday. Thank you for taking the time with me. I was especially noting how fond of your grandkids you were, and I'm a grandfather, too, and I love my grandkids, and I hope that you'll start to think about how these actions are affecting the planet for your grandkids. It's not about us anymore. It's about them. And his face lit up, and there was no conflict anymore. I could have hit it with science. I could have, yes, this is insulting. But instead,
I used what I thought was a granddad to granddad message. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to get to the hearts and minds of enough people to turn this thing around, to show them why it's important, to show them an alternative pathway that we can all be on for a safer future. And that, to me, that event, that was a life-changing event for me because, you know, I've got this New York attitude where I can go, you know, I can box with anybody. But instead, I channeled my heart and got into his heart and turned the whole conversation around. So I think that's where we got the, you know, the Carole Kings of the world and others that are trying to reach people's hearts and minds to see if we can change this around in time.
Did you think you actually changed this guy's opinion about what should be done?
I don't know, but I sure did avoid a conflict with him. And I think, you know, he kind of gave me a little wink of his eye. So I think I got through to him on that message. You know, I didn't do follow-up, so I really don't know, you know, whether or not if there's a bill that comes up across his desk that is proactive on climate change, if I changed him. But at least in that moment, maybe I got him to think differently.
So I want to talk a little bit more about what is your idea about using lobbying to stop logging the older forests and how that will really help us to deal with the climate crisis.
I've been working in old growth forests now for, I don't know, about 30 or 40 years. And my graduate career was part of this bio-blitzing that was taking place at the time where we were trying to get into as many of these areas to catalog their unique biodiversity to demonstrate to the world why they're so important. And it wasn't until the last 10 years or so that we started to take notice of the massive amount of carbon that is being drawn down from the atmosphere and stored long-term in these big trees and their dense soils, their productive soils. And people like Bev Law at Oregon State University and colleagues were measuring these with carbon flux towers and actually coming up with the numbers about how much carbon these forests were pulling down from the atmosphere and why they're so important as a natural climate solution. So we just have these stacked values now for these older forests. We know that they're biodiverse. We know that they are pulling massive amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere as a natural climate solution, and they also are wellsprings of clean water. They are really good at absorbing water, holding on to it during the dry summer months and gradually releasing it. And our cleanest drinking water is coming from these older forests that have not been logged. So when you look at these stacked benefits in a climate crisis, it makes no sense to be cutting down these mature and old growth forests because we need them as natural climate solutions.
So how do we keep them from getting cut down?
Yes, we get the president to issue a national rulemaking like what was done for the roadless area conservation rule back in 2000 and say that this is part of his climate forest legacy. And so that's what 150 or so groups are doing through two coalitions that I work with, the Forest Carbon Coalition and the Climate Forest Coalition that are both on the internet. And both of those coalitions are doing everything they can to make the case for why federal mature and old growth forests need to be protected through national rulemaking as natural climate solutions.
Well, I'm curious to learn a little bit more about what you're calling the older forests. I hadn't realized until just now, because when I was reading your paper, I thought that there were older forests in Oregon, too, that are not old growth, but they've grown back from logging. But is it just the forests that are in the east that where they stopped logging 100 years ago or more? I'm sort of familiar with some of those forests in New England, actually, that you could see where there had been farms back in the 19th century. You can still see the old stone walls. Is there anything equivalent to that in the Northwest?
Yeah, you know, the timber industry has been trying to delay action on protecting these forests, claiming that we can't define them. So we know that when these forests got a lot of big trees in them, and you got some dead trees, which define older characteristics, you've got gaps in the canopy, and that lets light levels in so that you get very complex understories with a lot of plants.
You've got logs on the ground that are nurse logs for the new seedlings, and you've got, you know, the snags. And those tend to come in at about 80 years or so. And then the older the forest, the more of those characteristics that you get. And so we can define these places. It's not an excuse not to protect them, because we know where they are now. We know how to define them. We just need to protect them as part of national rulemaking. And they do occur in Oregon, both mature and old growth. For example, the forests in eastern Oregon have gone through decades of high-grade logging, where the big sugar pines mostly were removed. And now you've got structure coming back decades later. Some of those forests are 80 to 100 years old. Some of them are 120. And they've got large tree structure in them. They're not old growth, but they're certainly mature. And if we're going to get old growth back, that's where we need to start, by protecting those large, older trees that are coming in from decades ago of logging.
Well, you're listening to Locust Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMON and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Sala with Wild Heritage in Talon, Oregon, about forests, wildfire, and climate chaos. One of the things that actually inspired me to contact you to do this show is something that I'm not even sure you know very much about, but I had this kind of alarming experience walking along the Timberline Trail on Mount Hood a few weeks ago, and it had been the first time I'd been on that stretch of trail in a couple years, and I saw all these trees that were dead, that hadn't been dead 2 years before. And it followed an area where there was a lot of windfall, which I think it happened in the couple windstorms that we've had, probably starting with the one in 2020, and then there was another windstorm about 6 months later. So I'm just wondering if you have any sense of what's going on in the alpine areas and how these trees might be being affected by climate change.
Yep, that's what's going on. And, you know, the high elevation areas are getting hit pretty impactfully by overheating planet. And so alpine areas are very sensitive communities that can't handle overheating. So when you have heat domes that have been increasing in frequency in our region and very weird temperatures during the summertime, those alpine areas are not resistant to those kinds of events. And so normally when we get these heat domes, we also get drought. And drought stress and heat are the double whammy on tree mortality. And so we're going to see a lot more of this happening because our heat dome frequency has been going up.
Yeah, I was actually kind of curious because this was on the north face of Mount Hood, which is supposedly the cooler face of the mountain. But it's also maybe the most exposed, and it's an area. This was not where the fire in 2011 burned, but it's not that far away from that fire. It's maybe about 5 miles west of the Dollar Lake fire. So I just wonder the conditions and why maybe at the north face there might be more sensitivity than there would be, because I've hiked in other parts of the Timberline Trail since then this summer and haven't seen the same kind of mortality.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know exactly what's going on there. It could be beetle infestation.
It didn't look like beetles. It's weird because when you go up to this area, when you're driving up to the trailhead, you go through this funny little forest, which has been this way for over 50 years, probably much longer than that, but I've been going up there for 50 years. And these trees are all stunted and they have lots of moss hanging from them. And it's a funny little forest. And then you get further up and you actually get into old growth forests and much more vibrant looking forests before you hit timberline. And then you're kind of at the edge of where there's still trees. And these trees look like the scrawny little trees that are down on the road. It was just a kind of a, and some of them look dead. Some of them just look like they were maybe in some phase of dying, but they really didn't look like beetle kill.
So just, yeah, I can only guess that it's drought stress.
Yeah, that's my thought. And then it made me think about the cedars, because I understand that cedar trees in the Northwest are really threatened. I'm wondering what you know about that.
Yeah, there are two cedar species that have been declining that are the result or the consequence of climate change and other factors. So in Alaska, it's Alaska yellow cedar that has been contracting its range
because of overheating and the loss of snowpack. And the interesting thing about yellow cedar in Alaska is the snowpack keeps the roots protected from the early spring heating. And because there's been less snow, there's less of that protective layer on the roots. The roots get exposed to high temperatures in early spring, and it's causing a big die-off of yellow cedar. And in our region, we have an endemic Port Orford cedar, which only grows in certain places in our region, that's been infected increasingly by a root rot fungus that travels on the bottom of cars and machinery and logging trucks and has been spreading in places like the Chelmeopsis. So those are two examples, and, you know, they're different species. One is not even a true cedar, but close enough for our discussion. But in any event, these are examples of how climate change can operate in conjunction with other anthropogenic disturbances to cause big tree die-offs. And we're going to see a lot more of this because of the increase in the heat domes.
Well, I was looking at the 10-day forecast on my phone this morning and saw that they're predicting temperatures into the 80s through the end of next week. And so that'll take us almost to the middle of October. And it's a little chilling to I guess that's not the right word. It's a little warming, maybe, to think about it being this warm in October in Portland. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about how that might affect plants. I mean, for one thing, my tomatoes seem to really like it because they got about 6 weeks late start. So they're going to probably ripen, and I was afraid they wouldn't. But I wonder about the forests and the native species that are dependent on a much different cycle of heat and cold than what we're seeing now.
Yeah, you should be worried, unfortunately. You know, I've done a lot of work with what we call downscaling global climate change models. And what those models do is they use the backcasting techniques to kind of look at the relationship between carbon dioxide and temperature, and then they go forecasting into the future in terms of if we have even more CO2, what does that mean for temperature increase? And so we've looked at these models, particularly for our region, and it's very troubling. And there will be places, if we continue on this path, that will lose their native plant associations. And there'll be a lag in the system because it takes a while for, you know, the new vegetation to come in and replace what was there and to do, you know, a big die-off. But we're seeing it already in parts of the Northwest where certain tree species are really starting to show increased signs of mortality. I'll give you an example. Down in the redwood zone, what we've seen there is a major decline in fog levels. And redwood are so tall that the only way they can get water up to their canopy is through fog drip. And so if you lose the fog, that's you know, kind of a death blow future for redwoods. And in the southernmost part of the redwood zone, the climate models predict that by mid to late century, those forests will shift increasingly to a climate conducive of subtropical plants. And places like in extreme southwest Oregon, where there's a little cluster of redwood, may be the climate refugia for redwood because it won't be hit with the extreme conditions of the southern end of its distribution. So we're going to see a lot of this where you might have pockets that persist in climate refugia and other places where the species just winks out. It's not there anymore. It's been replaced by something else that is drought or heat dome tolerant.
Well, to end on a maybe slightly more hopeful note, I'm wondering what you're planning on doing to do the best you can to make sure that we protect the older forests and the old growth forests that we've been talking about during this hour.
You know, I think everyone could be involved in this, and we really need to be leaning on our decision makers that we're in a climate crisis here, and the only way out of this is you've got to get off of fossil fuels, and we need to enlist natural climate solutions. Because we can't do one without the other. And, you know, even if we had the best carbon reduction fossil fuel emissions reduction program that we could possibly have. There's a lag in the system, and these natural climate solutions would buy us time. So in the state of Oregon, Oregon cannot meet its carbon reduction goals unless it protects its mature and old growth forest at the same time it's getting off of fossil fuels. That message needs to get out to our senators, our representatives, our government, our governor, and to the president that, you know, time is running out and this is the best way to prepare for the future. And by the way, these older, larger trees are more resistant and resilient to fire than plantations. We know that the big fires that are burning today are the combination of extreme fire weather caused by climate change and an industrially logged landscape that has primed the fire pump for the big fires we see today. The older forests are not the problem. The industrialized, logged over landscape is the problem, along with fossil fuels.
Well, Dominic, it's always great to talk to you. I really appreciate the work you're doing, and thanks so much for being on Locus Focus today.
Yeah, you bet. I'm sorry about the connectivity problem.
We'll work on that for next time.
All right, you bet.
Thanks a lot. We've been talking with Dominic Della Sala with Wild Heritage and Talent Oregon, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle Station's KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein, my engineer's Ray Bodwell. Next week, we talk with Yasha Vasov with Friends of Trees. We'll go out with music by John Hyatt. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask when necessary. Down here the river meets the sea. And in the sticky heat I feel you open up to me. Like rain, and it feels like rain. Lying underneath the star, right next to you. Like rain.
like rain. Like rain. And it feels like rain. So batten down the hatches, babe. Leave your heart out on your sleeve. Looks like we're in for stormy weather. That ain't no cause for us to leave. Just lie here in my arms and let it wash away the pain. Like rain. Baby, can you feel it?